It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The news of a leaked draft opinion by the U.S. Supreme Court suggesting Roe v. Wade might be overturned has rocked abortion rights advocates. Demonstrators gathered in downtown Pittsburgh last evening to demand federal protections for abortion rights. With us is Dr. Beatrice Chen. She's the medical director of Planned Parenthood of Western Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We do want to make it clear, this is a draft opinion that was leaked, and though its authenticity was confirmed, this isn't the final opinion of the court. Roe v. Wade is still currently in effect. Dr. Chen, when you heard the news of the leaked draft opinion, what ran through your mind?
What ran through my mind is that this is a devastating possibility for our patients, and that the Supreme Court is on the verge of taking away a person's rights to decide whether and when to have children. And this will have a devastating impact on pregnant people across the country who should have the right to make the decision that's best for themselves and their families.
I assume it wasn't unexpected, given the makeup of the court. It's just we were expecting official word sometime in June.
That's correct. As you had said earlier, the document that was released was a draft opinion and not the final ruling. Abortion is still legal at this time, and we're still caring for patients at this time.
What are you hearing from your colleagues across the country or elsewhere in Pennsylvania? And have you been in touch with them even prior to the leak of this opinion, this draft opinion, because things were moving forward along toward a decision?
We have been concerned about a potential ruling like this for a long time, and we've been working together across the country to ensure that pregnant people have the ability to access care in the states where care will still be available for them. I've been in contact with clinicians and physicians in other states, and healthcare clinicians who provide abortions are heartbroken over the potential impact of this ruling, of this potential ruling that could overturn Roe v. Wade. But we're all working together, and we're resolute in working together to provide compassionate and safe care for patients who need abortions.
So how are you coordinating that assistance that maybe in other states that already have some maybe severe restrictions? Pennsylvania has its own restrictions, but they're still safe and legal in Pennsylvania. How are you coordinating where patients can come to?
And here in Western Pennsylvania, we are surrounded by states like Ohio and West Virginia that could essentially ban abortion if Roe v. Wade is overturned. West Virginia has a pre-Roe ban that could go into effect if Roe v. Wade is overturned. And Ohio legislators have already expressed their intent to ban abortion to the maximum extent possible. And they have a six-week ban that's currently held up in the courts. And we've been working together, communicating across states, communicating via Zoom and other mechanisms like that to figure out how we can care for patients, patient navigators, things that we can do to help patients access care in different states where abortion will still be legal, even if Roe v. Wade is overturned.
Yes. In Ohio, in both the House and Senate, there are similar versions that would be a trigger ban at this time. Are you already seeing patients come here from other states that have strict restrictions?
Sadly, we are already seeing patients from Texas at the abortion facilities here in Pittsburgh. We're already seeing patients from Texas here in Pittsburgh. Right. People are already traveling. And these patients who are traveling are the people who have the means to travel. Unfortunately, overturning Roe v. Wade is going to have a disproportionate impact in the patients who don't have the resources to travel, people who are low income, people who live in rural areas, people who are younger, people of color, and this is going to increase healthcare disparities that already exist.
Mm-hmm. And transportation, as you alluded to, can be even another hurdle for some to overcome, one that may be insurmountable.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Abortion is, people still need abortion, regardless of whether or not it is legal. People are still going to be seeking abortion, and it's the people who have resources to travel who will be able to access safe care, and the people who don't have the resources to travel who may be trying to self-manage their abortions, potentially in unsafe manners. And this could potentially lead to increases in maternal morbidity and mortality across the country.
You mentioned patients already from Texas. What concerns do you have about providers suddenly having to treat patients from neighboring states, maybe an influx of patients?
This is definitely a concern. What we've seen from Texas after their ban was enacted, and their ban prohibited abortion if gestational cardiac activity was present, is that this overwhelms the clinics in neighboring states, and this resulted in delays in care for both patients who had to travel to receive an abortion, as well as in delays for patients in the state that they were traveling to due to limited appointment availability. So this is definitely a concern across the country.
Dr. Chen, what would you say that people maybe not understand about working in a health clinic that does perform abortions? What would you tell them?
I'd say that we are helping people make the decision that they feel is best for themselves, that they have the rights, the ability to choose whether and when to have a children is a human right, and we are helping them provide them with that right. Abortion is essential health care, and people know what's best for themselves and their families.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that you have been talking with colleagues across the country before and after this draft was leaked. But have you spoken to any of your patients since the draft opinion was leaked? And if so, what are they telling you?
Patients are afraid. They're afraid that they're going to lose access to care. And we're trying to reassure them that abortion is still legal. Our doors are still open and we're still providing care.
So let me follow up with that. So what is right now the state of access to abortion here in Pennsylvania?
Right now, we are still providing care. Right now, abortion is still legal. We have state restrictions in place, and we comply with those state restrictions of the 24-hour waiting period, of medical assistance not paying for abortions, except in cases of rape, incest, or threat to life, which, again, disproportionately affects the people who have the fewest resources to access care.
Do you think people maybe not understand what the current restrictions are until they might need or want your services and then need to find out more?
This is definitely true. I frequently see patients who never thought they would be in the position where they would choose to have an abortion, but when they're faced with a situation, they're making the choice that's best for themselves and their families. They may already be a parent and want to focus on providing the best care they can for the children they already have. Or they may have health conditions that could make pregnancy difficult or dangerous for them. Or they may have been the survivor of sexual assault, or they may have encountered a devastating fetal diagnosis not compatible with survival. Childbirth and adoption are not always viable options. And if Roe v. Wade is overturned, patients in states where abortion is highly restricted or not legal will not have the ability to make the private decision that's best for themselves and their families.
Dr. Chen, so what are you expecting over the next weeks? And maybe official ruling comes down next month. And whether it's nationally or here in Pennsylvania, what are you expecting your work to be like and for the conditions for your patients?
We are going to continue to work together to collaborate to provide care for our patients. We're going to continue to work across state lines to take care of patients who may need to travel. Traveling to receive abortion can be difficult. People need gas money. People need transportation. People need childcare. People need housing. And so we're going to continue to work together to provide care for our patients.
Dr. Beatrice Chen is the medical director of Planned Parenthood of Western Pennsylvania. Dr. Chen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An immigration court in Pittsburgh that served those in the region and the whole of West Virginia is now closed. Advocates for undocumented immigrants are now pushing to find alternatives, saying those who had hearings scheduled might not be able to make it to Philadelphia, the nearest physical court, or join virtually. Laura Perkins is the emergency response organizer with Casa San Jose. She joins us now. Welcome, Laura. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what kind of cases does the court typically hear when it was here in Pittsburgh?
Sure. So anyone that has come to the United States that needs to prove their legal status does see an immigration judge. And so that includes a lot of asylum seekers. Asylum seekers have the right to come into U.S. territory and ask for asylum within 1 year of being present in U.S. territory. So it's a legal right established by international law and U.S. law. And so they're just going through their proceedings.
Mm-hmm. About roughly, can you tell us how many cases did the court hear in a week or whatever time frame you wish?
I'm not sure. You'd have to check with the immigration courts themselves, especially since the Pittsburgh court also services all of West Virginia. But I would probably guess around 30 if I had to guess.
Okay. What is Casa San Jose, what is your role in assisting these individuals who go to court?
Sure. So I'm the emergency response organizer at Casa San Jose. So I deal, I respond to ICE detentions, and I also do a lot of Know Your Rights sessions. We have a court accompaniment program where especially folks that do not have immigration attorneys have often a bilingual volunteer that goes with them and makes sure that everything goes okay for them. We don't ever translate or provide court services, but we do witness a lot of immigration court hearings.
Mm-hmm. Are you ever there personally for them while they are undergoing these or participating in these court proceedings?
Yeah, I'm often there. Actually, I even got a call from the Pittsburgh Immigration Court judge a while back thanking me for kind of helping out with the logistics, because in the Pittsburgh court, which closed on Friday, I was often running around trying to help people, letting them know what their rights are, connecting them with resources, letting them know that they do have a right to an interpreter, even if it's not there, stuff like that. So, yeah, we're pretty active.
To understand the setup, is the judge actually in Philadelphia and the individuals are here in Pittsburgh in an office? Well, they were until it was closed on Friday, provided by the federal office. And so it was a virtual connection via that office. Is that how it worked?
That's correct. Yeah. So before, there used to be an interpreter in the Pittsburgh office that did a lot of logistical works. But yeah, it's a pretty small room with a big screen. And on that screen were the folks in Philadelphia, which would be the judge, the prosecuting attorney, the interpreter, and any court personnel.
So what are the options right now that the Pittsburgh office has closed?
Yeah. So from the memo that was issued by the Executive Office of Immigration Review, which coordinates national immigration courts, we were told that they could either go to Philadelphia or they would be provided a way to attend via video call. In my work, I have seen that option for a New York court, and it's through WebEx. And I spent half an hour on the phone with a community member trying to explain exactly how to attend that hearing. And we have to acknowledge that not everyone is privileged with technological literacy. And so the fact that we're putting someone's immigration case, which could potentially end in deportation, in the hands of technology is quite frightening.
Last week, your organization indicated it would be meeting with or hope to meet with the Department of Homeland Security. Did that meeting ever happen?
Yeah, there was some confusion about stakeholder. It was a stakeholders meeting, but there was no one from the Department of Justice or the Executive Office of Immigration Review in that meeting. So it's been very frustrating. This has been a rush process and with a complete lack of transparency, so that the community members are not getting the right information. And again, not getting the right information could end in deportation for folks, just because of confusion, not for a lack of wanting to comply.
No,
we are looking to coordinate with local like city officials to try to look for an alternative site. or also with senators, just to try to make something happen, because this cannot happen for our community.
All right, you mentioned trying to coordinate with city, county officials. Are you looking maybe space in the, because the feds said that there was limitations, space and personnel. Are you looking for maybe space in the county courthouse or somewhere else?
That's not for me to decide. As a nonprofit worker, I would leave the decision up to them. But I think there are a lot of options, and I think there is money to pay for a space. We just need a will to do that.
So the limitations are, or the difficulties are, maybe some of the individuals are not all that internet savvy. Like a lot of us are not all that internet savvy. And then, or they could go to Philadelphia, but transportation can be a challenge as well.
Yeah, exactly. So often it's not just one person that has a hearing. It's often two parents and three children, which would mean five bus tickets to get to Philadelphia and back. There's three Greyhound buses that go to Philadelphia, so they might have to wake up at 1 a.m. to catch one of those buses if the immigration court is at 8:30. It takes away their support system. It's already a very confusing process. So it's just putting our community in danger unnecessarily.
The statement from the Immigration Review Office also says, at this time. Do you believe this is a permanent closure?
I certainly hope not. Mm-hmm.
So in the days ahead, the weeks ahead, while you're looking for alternatives, how are you helping individuals who can't travel to Philadelphia, are not necessarily internet savvy? What can you do for them until maybe a viable alternative comes about?
Yeah, community members know that they can always call our office, 412-343-3111, and we are going to share everything we know on social media when it comes to us.
Can you offer internet help, maybe at your facility or somewhere else?
Yeah, but also it's the job of the government to make this accessible. This is not our job. We are here to support the community, but it is not our job to do that.
Laura Perkins is the emergency response organizer with Casa San Jose. Thanks so much, Laura.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. In Pittsburgh, there's a neighborhood named for war. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on the history of the Mexican War Streets for our Good Question series.
On the north side, nestled between Allegheny Center, Manchester, and East Allegheny, there's a neighborhood with an unusual name. We've gotten a lot of good questions about this community.
My name is Jeffrey Kaczynski. I'm from Newcastle, Pennsylvania. How did the Mexican War Streets get its name?
Listener Nathan Bell had a similar query.
That name just stood out to me because I wondered what Mexican War it references, since it doesn't seem likely that geographically Pittsburgh was directly involved in a war with Mexico.
Bell's right. Pittsburgh wasn't a battleground during the Mexican-American War, but the city did play a role in the conflict. Here's some quick background. In 1845, the United States annexed Texas from Spain. Mexicans were upset because they considered it part of their land. Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall and Museum curator Michael Krause says the next year, Mexican soldiers initiated a war with the Americans living in Texas, and America responded.
And we send troops down there, and then we invade Mexico.
Men from the Pittsburgh region enlisted to fight in the conflict.
The president called for volunteer troops from the states, and Pennsylvania provided two regiments, the 1st Pennsylvania Infantry and the 2nd Pennsylvania Infantry. And both of those had companies from Pittsburgh.
These regiments actually left for the war from Pittsburgh, taking the river down to New Orleans before shipping off to strategic battlefields. Once they arrived, they encountered what would have been fairly common for combat in the mid-1800s.
It's like rock'em sock'em robots. I mean, you're talking about muzzle-loading weapons, you know, that are do not have an effective range of more than 100 to 200 yards. So that's how close you're going to have to be to your enemy if you're a foot soldier, an infantry soldier.
Cavalry troops fought on horseback. Cannons that could fire up to about a mile away were key weapons. Krause says the Americans focused on taking Mexican forts.
A lot of times the tactic to knock those or disable that fortification is surrounding it and cutting it off from everything else.
Despite large numbers of Mexican fighters, the U.S. troops prevailed, and the conflict ended after 2 years in 1848.
It's a very short war, but we're fighting an international war outside of our boundaries, kind of the beginning of colonialism.
Around the same time, in what was then Allegheny City, people were beginning to settle in a new neighborhood. Krause says former Allegheny City Mayor William Robinson had purchased land there on the north side and was building and naming streets.
What better tribute than to name it after what was going on right then?
There's Monterey, Palo Alto, and Resaca Streets, all named after significant battles in the war. And there's Taylor Avenue, after President Zachary Taylor, and Fremont Street, after Captain John Fremont. The area, named after the victorious war, was settled by a variety of people. On a recent rainy day, I met Mexican War Street Society Vice President Brittany Urban to learn more about the community.
We are currently sitting outside of the Commonplace Coffee at the corner of Jacksonia and Buena Vista Street in the Mexican War Streets on the beautiful north side of Pittsburgh.
She says some of the first residents of the neighborhood worked as blacksmiths or merchants. There were also many farmers.
Drover's Way is an alley that exists right over there. And so drover is like a person who drives cattle.
Residents here found success. They had moved into modest homes and over time were able to expand them to roughly what stands today. In 1907, Pittsburgh annexed Allegheny City, including the Mexican War Streets neighborhood. But in the 1970s and 80s, Urban says the area started to struggle. It developed a poor reputation and people said they didn't feel safe there. That started to change when cultural groups took an interest and opened places like the Mattress Factory, Randyland, and the Writers' Refugee Space, City of Asylum. They brought positive attention to the community and made it a lot more colorful.
So over time, thank goodness, this area has been attractive to people who could see its potential and beauty and decided to work toward preserving it and turning it into something really beautiful and useful.
As a designated historic district, the Mexican War Streets tries to preserve an authentic character. There's a lot of quirk here, too. A few years ago, two Venezuelan artists installed brightly colored words on windows, gates, and doors. The project was called River of Words, and each one was relevant to Pittsburgh in some way. Zombie, baseball, Atlas. The installation was supposed to be temporary, but many residents liked them so much, they kept them up. While the neighborhood's name might conjure something aggressive, the people here are anything but. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we talk with Patrice O'Neill, director of the documentary Repairing the World, Stories from the Tree of Life. Thanks to our team, Laura Satsui and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.